Hello, and welcome back to another installment of In Summation, Rap Stars Make the Best Criminals. I'm Paul Townsend, creator and host, and today we dive back into artistic expression in the form of rap music, and another famous rapper who found himself hounded by the long arm of the law. Not long ago, we looked at the mistrial of YNW Melly, the up-and-coming Florida rapper accused of killing two people in his rap entourage. In today's episode, we're going to go back to a case from the 1990s. We're traveling back to the golden age of rap music. And what we call rap music, or poetry recited in rhythm and rhyme over a pre-recorded instrumental track, first came onto the scene in the 1970s. It was a phenomenon of the inner cities, a style of music giving voice to a swath of the population uninterested in the flamboyance of disco or the angst of rock and roll. But let's not forget that rap music didn't really start as a mouthpiece for gangsters. Original hip-hop songs were actually largely wholesome, sometimes comical. It was storytelling to the beat. One of the first songs to bring hip-hop to the mainstream was the Sugar Hill Gang's Rapper's Delight in 1979, which is still a hit at high school dances across the country and requires no censorship for language or themes. Now, when you think of the big rap stars of the 1990s, you jump to DMX, Notorious B.I.G., Tupac Shakur, Busta Rhymes, N.W.A., Public Enemy, and many others. Their songs were about frustration, violence, anger, fighting back. And the subject of today's episode is very much in that genre. By the 90s, rap was a weapon used to fight back against the man, against the establishment, against the system, and sometimes against law and order itself. Now, this podcast is not here to ask the question of whether gangster rap is an accurate reflection of urban mayhem or an inspiration for it. What we are here to do is explain the facts and arguments which led to one of the biggest trials of the 1990s. At the time, it was up there with the Michael Jackson trial in terms of its notoriety. On August 25th, 1993, an aspiring rap star, fast gaining notoriety in the Los Angeles rap scene, known for his unique voice and signature cadence, was in his apartment. He heard a commotion outside, and his bodyguard, a man named McKinley Lee, who was known as Malik, went to go check it out. Lee found one of the rapper's friends, Sean Abrams, arguing with some local rival street gang members. When Lee came outside and joined Abrams, the other gang members left, but the rapper was watching from his window. One of the gang members he saw was a 20-year-old Ethiopian immigrant named Philip Waldemariam. Later that day, Abrams, Lee, and our protagonist were driving in the rapper's Jeep when they found Waldemariam again. The rapper had recognized Waldemariam as a man who had threatened him with a gun recently while filming a music video on the streets of Los Angeles. The rapper pulled the Jeep over and the three men confronted Waldemariam, whose body was discovered shot to death at a nearby carport. After briefly going into hiding, the rapper turned himself into authorities and was charged, along with Lee and Abrams, with the murder of Philip Waldemariam. This is the state of California versus Calvin Brodus, better known worldwide as Snoop Doggy Dogg.
Like a few friends is a breeze through. Don't you know it's too in the morning and our party's still jumping, 'cause my mama ain't home.
The man known as Calvin Cortazar Brodus Jr. was born October 20th, 1971 in Long Beach, California. His father was Vernell Vernado and his mother was Beverly Tate. Okay, yes, he is Calvin Brodus Jr. and his father's name is Vernell Vernado. But as it turns out, his father abandoned the family when Brodus was 3 years old, so he was actually renamed for his stepfather, Calvin Cortazar Brodus Sr. He was the second of three sons born to Beverly Tate. And the marriage between Tate and Brodus Sr., however, was fairly short-lived. They divorced in 1975. Snoop Dogg's biological father was almost entirely absent from his life. He took the stage name Snoop Dogg because when he was very young, his mother nicknamed him Snoopy after the Peanuts cartoon strip character because he loved the comics so much. Rodas was always extremely musically inclined. He played piano and sang at the Golgotha Trinity Baptist Church while he was in middle school. Also in middle school, he delivered newspapers, sold candy, and worked bagging groceries to make a couple extra dollars to give to his mother to help her pay bills. His mother, Miss Tate, did everything she could to keep him on the straight and narrow path. He spent a lot of time at church and in school and working whatever odd jobs he could find. Rodas says that he first began rapping around sixth grade. He would rap in the school hallways and draw massive crowds. Because of this notoriety, he began to draw the attention of the very people his mother so adamantly tried to keep him away from. And despite Beverly Tate's best efforts, Rodas began to start getting in trouble with the law. Although he denied it for years, he has now admitted quite proudly that he joined the Rolling Twenties crew of the Crips Gang. Despite this, he did manage to graduate from Long Beach Polytechnic High School in 1989 with fairly good grades. But not long after graduation, he was arrested for cocaine possession and found himself in Wayside Jail. Rodas would spend a good portion of the next few years coming out of jail, then going back in, coming out, going back in. But while he was out, he was spending a lot of time with his cousin, Nate Dogg, and their mutual friend, Warren G, making mixtapes. Rodas recorded a freestyle over the En Vogue record Hold On, which made its way to rapper and producer Dr. Dre in 1991. Dre called Rodas in and asked him to audition. Dre's production company was then called Future Shock, but that would soon become Powerhouse Death Row Records. With Dre as a mentor and the rest of this Death Row family aiding him in honing his craft, Snoop Doggy Dogg took off like a shot. First, Rodas, now fully Snoop Doggy Dogg, worked with Dr. Dre on a theme song for the 1992 film Deep Cover. Then it was features on Dre's album, The Chronic. The Chronic was a massive success, and Snoop became a name in the rap industry. In 1991, the biggest name rappers were Tupac, NWA, Public Enemy, and De La Soul. They were gritty, they were aggressive, they could be harsh. But Snoop Doggy Dogg was different. He had a smoothness to his voice. He had an almost funky rhythm to his beats. There was nobody out there that sounded like him. In the early stages of this iteration of rap music, artists leaned into their beginnings on the street. Many were gang members. Many had felony records. And that was viewed, rightly or wrongly, as a way to give these individuals an air of credibility. They knew what they were rapping about. They understood violence, drugs, prostitution, robbery, weapons. Now, this isn't a political podcast by any stretch, but I will say that it is interesting to me that in an era where social justice crusaders can command immediate apologies from Beyonce or Lizzo or even Taylor Swift, rappers like Eminem, DMX, Snoop Dogg, Nas, NWA, and others have unapologetically glorified misogyny and homophobia, and nobody has ever made a serious attempt to cancel them. And love it or hate it, this breed of rappers was, if nothing else, authentic. The money and fame was seemingly diametrically opposed to the persona that these individuals owned. In many ways, rappers in the 1990s could not escape their humble street beginnings. We don't see today situations quite like the murders of superstars Notorious B.I.G. and Tupac Shakur. Rapper artists are far less common now and are far more likely to be arrested for nonviolent crimes when they happen. Although, as we have seen with rappers like YNW Melly, it still does happen. It just doesn't have the frequency that it did in the 1990s. Perhaps decades of accolades and success in society have tempered the behavior or taught rappers how to stay out of jail and enjoy the fruits of their labor. But in the time period we're looking at today, even rising stars like Snoop Dogg still adhered to the code of the streets. They lived by it, regardless of what else was going on in their lives. So let's set the scene here. It's August 25th, 1993. Snoop is in his Los Angeles apartment with bodyguard McKinley Lee, who goes by Malik. Malik Lee and Snoop hear some shouting outside. People are getting heated. Snoop goes to the window to check it out, while Malik Lee heads downstairs and out the door to investigate. Lee comes out to find Sean Abrams, a friend of Brodus, outside hanging with a group of guys in a car, chiefly speaking to a young man named Philip Waldemarion, who went by the street name Lil Smooth. Waldemarion, a 20-year-old immigrant from Ethiopia, was also in the Crips, but in a rival section, and he accused Snoop of moving in on his group's turf. Lil Smooth, aka Waldemarion, was a member of the BYS Hustler Crips, or the By Yourself Hustler Crips. He had recently forced his way into Brodus' music video filming on the streets of Los Angeles. Brodus' crew had taken over a city block, and Waldemarion had brazenly intruded on the set and was waving a gun around, causing a scene before being ejected from the video shoot. Fortunately, no shots were fired and no one was injured, but still, Waldemarion's actions had bothered both Brodus and the rest of his particular subsection of the Crips. Lee's arrival downstairs caused Waldemarion and his friends to leave Abrams and drive away, but not before Brodus noticed who it was from his window. He made a mental note that this was the same guy waving a gun in his music video shoot, and now he was outside his apartment getting into arguments with his friends. With Lil Smooth leaving the scene, Abrams and Lee returned upstairs to Brodus' apartment. Later that day, Brodus was out driving his black Jeep Cherokee, and Malik Lee and Sean Abrams were in the car with him. They were driving past the Palms Park when they saw Waldemarion with his friends Jason London and Deshaun Joseph sitting at a picnic table eating tacos. Accounts of what transpired varied, as you can imagine, with the defense claiming that Waldemarion pulled a gun first and Lee fired in self-defense, and the prosecution claiming that Waldemarion was attempting to defuse a heated situation when Malik Lee pulled out a gun and shot him in cold blood. Here is what both sides basically agreed to. Both London and Joseph were present and observed everything. When the Jeep rolled up, Waldemarion shouted out, "I ain't trying to sweat you, but I am letting you know where you're at." This being a reference to Brodus and his crew being in the By Yourself Hustlers territory. Lee responded by saying, "You ain't letting us know anything, punk." Now, apparently being called a punk in this particular neighborhood of Los Angeles was a serious call to violence. Guns were drawn, and Waldemarion is shot and killed. Initially, law enforcement did not find a gun at the scene near Waldemarion's body. But a few months later, they discovered Waldemarion's .380 pistol, which had been taken by London and Joseph prior to the police arriving in an attempt to aid their now-deceased friend and make him look like a defenseless victim. Immediately after the shooting, Brodus and Lee went underground. We're going to be talking mostly about Brodus and a little bit about Lee, as he's the actual shooter. Abrams was involved here, and although initially charged, he ended up having the charges against him dismissed prior to trial, so we don't really need to discuss his participation any further. Lee and Brodus spent about a week in hiding, with law enforcement unable to locate them in Greater Los Angeles. And according to legend, and generally accepted, although I will say it's unconfirmed, the hiding and the resulting surrender were orchestrated by Death Row Records head Suge Knight. Knight wanted to capitalize on the sensationalism of the whole situation in anticipation of Snoop Doggy Dogg's upcoming debut album, Doggy Style, which was set to release in a few months. He also wanted Snoop to make his scheduled appearance at the Video Music Awards, which were slated to take place a week after the shooting. So he set up a way for Snoop and Lee to stay in hiding for a week. With a warrant for his arrest over his head, Snoop Doggy Dogg appeared at the VMAs. He did interviews with Dr. Dre, and he presented the award for Best R&B Record. After the VMAs were over, Knight arranged for Brodus's voluntary surrender to the LAPD. Amazingly, despite being on the run for a week, Brodus had bail set, and Suge Knight bailed him out for $1 million. Doggy Style was then released in November 1993. It sold 800,000 copies in its first week, setting records for fastest and best-selling debut LP by a rapper. It went platinum in under 6 months. Snoop Doggy Dogg was a rap superstar. One of the major reasons for the album's success was the track Murder Was the Case, followed in 1995 by a short film starring Brodus and Charlie Murphy, directed by Dr. Dre and Fab Five Freddy. The movie was a sort of odd semi-biographical account where Snoop Dogg is both involved in a killing, but is also killed in a very strained metaphor about how gang life winds up with everyone dead. But then Snoop makes a deal with the devil to come back and do it all over again. It's worth checking out. From a PR perspective, it was genius. It was able to cast Brodus as more a victim of the street lifestyle than a gangbanger who was involved in shooting a man to death. Snoop, while out on bail, appeared again at the 1994 VMAs, performing in a wheelchair, and ended his set by proclaiming his innocence and then walking off stage. Now, sadly, this is not how the American legal system works, and prosecutors in Los Angeles County were still demanding a trial. Let's talk legal team now. Brodus was fully backed by Death Row Records, and they wanted to win. Knight saw so much potential in Brodus that he was committed to doing whatever it took to beat the charges. Knight founded Brodus to hire attorney David Kenner, as well as Johnny Cochran, who is now a household name because of the O.J. Simpson trial. In California in 1993, this was a death penalty eligible case, meaning essentially that the only thing keeping Snoop Doggy Dogg off of death row was Death Row Records. Later in interviews, Brodus recounted that he had a conversation with Cochran while he was representing both Brodus and Simpson shortly before Simpson's trial. He said Cochran told him that he was only going to be able to get one of them off, that white America was never going to accept not guilty verdicts for both men. Soon after, the O.J. Simpson trial started, and Cochran spent the next 11 months battling for Simpson. And when the jury returned a not guilty verdict, Brodus said that he immediately went from elation for Simpson to terror for what that meant for his own very high-profile trial, which was now not far away. Though his trial was going to be conducted by David Kenner, a prominent criminal defense attorney in his own right, Johnny Cochran did not try Snoop Doggy Dogg's case. The lead prosecutor on the case was Edward Neeson. And Neeson was not exactly taken with Brodus's celebrity. He felt that gangster rap was a scourge on society, which encouraged and incited violence in the streets and lawless behavior. He felt that it glorified antisocial activities, and he viewed the Brodus trial as an opportunity to send a message that even celebrity gang members go to prison. The prosecution's case was that Brodus had masterminded the whole shooting, that he was fueled by hatred for Waldemarium, that he felt slighted, and the law of the streets required that he respond with violence. He orchestrated the drive-by shooting and commanded that Lee kill Waldemarium while he drove by. Neeson argued that Brodus and Lee had spent hours hunting for Waldemarium that day and finally found him in the Palms Park, where he ultimately was shot dead. To Neeson's credit, he didn't try to do too much. He recognized that his two star eyewitnesses, Jason London and Deshaun Joseph, were also gang members, testifying about the death of their friend with their own credibility issues. But as the case unfolded, Neeson was hit with additional setback after setback. First, the LAPD lost the shell casings recovered at the scene. And this was more of an embarrassment than a crucial evidentiary failure, as Lee was not disputing that he shot and killed Waldemarium. So linking the bullet to the gun through a shell casing was not a necessary element to identify the shooter. But still, anytime firearms or ballistic evidence is recovered from a crime scene and then lost before the trial, the jury is left with the impression that the police screwed something up really bad, which they did. But far more damaging was the eventual testimony of London and Joseph. In their initial statements to the police, they had said that Lee shot Waldemariam after a verbal argument and that Waldemariam was unarmed and was trying to de-escalate the situation. By the time the trial had begun, they had recanted and admitted that Waldemariam had had a .380 pistol in his waistband and that they had made the gun disappear from the scene prior to the police arrival to make Waldemariam seem like a defenseless victim. London also admitted on cross-examination that Waldemariam had a reputation for irrational behavior and that Brodus wasn't a part of the apartment complex confrontation earlier that day. And possibly the most damaging of all was that Joseph testified on cross-examination that it appeared that Waldemariam was going for his gun immediately prior to getting shot. Another key witness who ended up falling flat was the Los Angeles County Medical Examiner. The ME report showed the gunshot wounds were to Waldemariam's back and buttocks, suggesting that Waldemariam had been attempting to run away from Lee as he was being shot. And that certainly would contradict any self-defense claim Lee wanted to make. But on cross-examination, the medical examiner admitted that in his report, he had described the wounds as lateral, meaning they traveled sideways, which would be consistent with somebody swirling around on a picnic table bench drawing an object from his waistband. Kenner applied a two-pronged defense. The first prong was that the LAPD was incredibly sloppy, did a poor job of investigating, jumped to conclusions not backed by evidence, failed to consider any evidence that contradicted their narrative, and lost or destroyed evidence. Now, this tied naturally into the second prong, which was that Lee had shot Waldemariam in self-defense, that he had been sitting at the bench, they had argued, and Waldemariam was in the process of getting off that bench, twisting around while drawing his gun from his waistband. And Kenner tried the case perfectly. He knew exactly what to focus on and where to direct the jury's attention. He harped on the shell casings lost by the LAPD. He harped on the fact that Waldemariam's bloody clothing had been accidentally destroyed by the LAPD. He harped on the lies intentionally told by Waldemariam's friends Joseph and London about who had guns that day. They later recanted with admission that Waldemariam did in fact have a gun. And the shell casings and the bloody clothes were total red herrings for the jury. They had next to no value for this particular case. Now, there are plenty of cases where a shell casing may have a fingerprint, or DNA, or microscopy might match it to a particular gun, which establishes some fact that a prosecutor wants to argue. But in this case, there was no dispute that Malik Lee fired the gun which killed Waldemariam. The issue is why. So the shell casings really didn't add anything to any discussion on that particular topic. Similarly, bloody clothes are useful to shock a jury to present the real visual of the injuries or the harm done or the amount of blood that was gushing out of a particular victim. It gives the prosecutor a physical object to hold up in court, something to shake in front of the jury while condemning the defendant and demanding that the jury hold him accountable. But as far as real evidentiary value to prove a case, unless it's a case where the defense is arguing that no one was actually injured by the defendant's actions, bloody clothes just confirm what we already knew. Someone was shot to death, and while they were shot, they were bleeding onto their clothing. But when law enforcement loses or destroys evidence, no matter how inconsequential, when something they collect or document is accidentally destroyed or misplaced, defense attorneys know how to manipulate that narrative and plant seeds of doubt about what other failings the prosecutor might be trying to gloss over. Maybe there was critical evidence that wasn't collected. Or maybe there was other exculpatory evidence that was also destroyed and the defense was never alerted to. There's also really not much a prosecutor can say in this situation. Neeson himself wasn't responsible for safeguarding the stuff. It wasn't his negligence that led to it getting lost or destroyed. But he can't throw the LAPD under the bus. Getting past the fact that they need a good working relationship with the police department, it would harm his case to shine a spotlight on issues of police misconduct or negligence. The only real thing that the district attorney's office or the U.S. attorney's office, case may be, can do is try to explain to the jury why those things don't matter. But then that looks like they're hiding something. It's bad any way you cut it. And Neeson tried his best to explain away the losses and why they didn't matter. But in the end, he was forced to concede that certain pieces of evidence weren't available and that law enforcement was the reason why. And Neeson was also forced to admit that his chief eyewitnesses, Walda Merriam's friends London and Joseph, had lied to the police when they arrived after the shooting. That Walda Merriam did in fact have a gun that day and that they had taken and hidden it. So he would appear to be an innocent victim. This was really a crippling blow to Neeson's case. And he had to know that his witnesses were going to have credibility issues already. First, they were friends of the person who was shot, so they're biased against the defendants because those are the rival gang members who just killed their boy. Second, they're gang members themselves, which in 1990s Los Angeles meant that polite society viewed them as thugs and ruffians. The word of a gang member was simply not going to be credited like the word of a banker or an accountant would be. Joseph and London were also no strangers to law enforcement themselves. And good defense attorneys will frequently ask witnesses for the prosecution about their own criminal history, especially if they're involved in any criminal behavior involving dishonesty, fraud, theft, or even violence. In this case, the fact that these gang members lied to the cops immediately reinforced every stereotype leveled at them by the defense lawyers. So let's dive into the real substantive argument that Brodus's lawyers were pushing. Self-defense. What's the legal definition? What does a defendant have to establish? How often is this successful at a trial? The concept of self-defense is pretty standard. Everyone understands the basics. If you're the target of an attack, you can defend yourself. But naturally, there are limits. No one would think it reasonable for someone being hit with a pool noodle to shoot an attacker dead. Every jurisdiction has some sort of proportionality requirement. And what this means is the force applied back at the attacker must be in some way proportional to the force of the attack being perpetrated on you. This is considered in conjunction with the potential requirement that a person may have to retreat in some states if it is at all possible. What's commonly referred to as the stand your ground rule became fairly well known after the George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin confrontation in Florida. Zimmerman, you may recall, argued that Martin had attacked him and that he was defending himself when he killed Martin. Florida imposes no duty to retreat. You are permitted to stand your ground and defend yourself. Some states, however, mandate that if a person has the ability to get away from an attacker, they are required to do it. You are not permitted to respond with force unless you cannot reasonably get yourself out of the situation without using that force. A person who has the clear opportunity to retreat in a jurisdiction which imposes the duty to retreat cannot legally claim self-defense, and a judge is not likely to give the jury an instruction telling them that they can find the defendant not guilty on the grounds of self-defense. So let's look at our scenario. Brodus is behind the wheel of the Jeep with the engine on, some distance away from Walda Merriam and his friends, while his bodyguard was engaging in a bit of verbal provocation. And California is a stand-your-ground state, just like Florida. And the argument was that Lee observed Walda Merriam going for his gun. He reasonably believed that he and Brodus were about to either be seriously injured or killed. In California, that can authorize the use of deadly physical force in response. So, in California, In a situation where someone is pulling a gun on you, you are not legally required to try and get away. You can use deadly physical force to prevent yourself from being killed or suffering a serious injury. But how does that work at trial? If you listen to past episodes of this show, or if you have an interest in criminal law and criminal trials in general, you're probably aware that the burden of proof is always on the prosecution. The defense is never required to prove the innocence of their client. The issue of the burden of proof is an instruction given to every jury in every criminal trial. It's what's called a pattern instruction, meaning that it's given in the same form each and every time a jury is given their final charges and instructions right before deliberation. It's a bedrock principle in our system that prosecutors are required to prove the defendant's guilt and not that a defendant is required to prove his innocence. Because of this, a lot of people stumble over the concept of the affirmative defense. If it's up to the defendant to show that he or she acted in self-defense, doesn't that shift the burden over to the defense in a way that every jury is told will never happen? Now, there's a lot of nuance here, so I'll try and be as straightforward as possible while being true to the legal concepts. The burden of proof never shifts. The industry has created a distinction between the burden of proof, which is always, always, always on the prosecutor, and the burden of production, which is a burden on the defense if it chooses to assert an affirmative defense. Think of it this way. The prosecutor is always required to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. That means that a prosecutor is required to prove each and every element of the crimes that they are charging. They have to establish the conduct and produce enough evidence that a reasonable juror could conclude that the defendant had the required mental state to commit the crime as well. If the prosecutor fails to do this, then the jury is legally bound to acquit, regardless of what the defense was or whether one was even put forward. The defense does not have to prove anything, and if the prosecutor cannot prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, then there should not be a conviction. Full stop. Now, there are cases where the defense acknowledges that the defendant did the behavior which the prosecutor is alleging took place, but argues that for some other reason, the defendant is not legally responsible for committing a crime. These are the affirmative defenses. Typically speaking, robbing a bank is a crime. However, if Jared straps a bomb to Eric's chest and tells Eric that if he doesn't rob a bank, he will detonate the bomb and blow him up, that will negate Eric's culpability in robbing a bank, because Eric is not considered to be robbing the bank of his own free will. He is under considerable duress. Same theory would apply if Jared took Eric's family hostage and told Eric he would kill them all if Eric did not rob a bank. A person who is being coerced or is under duress is not legally responsible for actions that they are essentially being forced to commit. Another affirmative defense is justification. If another person's actions put you in a position where you must take some form of responsive action, typically in the form of self-defense, then even if you wound or kill the other person, if it was necessary to prevent your own serious physical injury or death, then it is not a criminal action. Now, self-defense is very context-specific, and it is up to the defense to produce sufficient evidence so that a reasonable juror could conclude that the force was necessary to prevent that serious physical injury or death that we've been talking about. And then it's up to the judge to determine whether the defense has made the required factual showing so that he or she will read the jury instruction telling them that if they determine that the defendant acted in self-defense and that such actions were necessary, then they must find the defendant not guilty. When the defense raises an affirmative defense, it is then on the prosecutor to disprove that defense beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the burden of the prosecution when an affirmative defense is raised. the prosecution still has to prove the elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt, but then they also must prove that the affirmative defense should not apply beyond a reasonable doubt. That means the prosecutor has to prove that the action was not self-defense. Okay, so now you understand the affirmative defense of justification by self-defense. Let's really get deep on the issue in this particular case, because it's Malik Lee who shot Woldemariam, not Calvin Brodus. Brodus was essentially accused of just making the situation happen, driving around looking for Woldemariam, encouraging Lee to shoot him, and then putting Lee in a position so that he could shoot him. So can Brodus argue self-defense when he's charged with essentially aiding and abetting the murder? As much as it may feel a bit counterintuitive, the answer is yes. A defendant is permitted to argue self-defense in these circumstances. Now, obviously, if the jury did not buy Malik Lee's claims of self-defense, they could not buy that same claim for Brodus. But it is not legally inconsistent for a jury to conclude that Woldemariam's actions put all of the individuals inside the Jeep in reasonable fear for their life, and therefore Lee's actions in self-defense can actually apply to all of the defendants. But David Kenner masterfully tied the self-defense and police incompetence threads together in this case and turned the jury against the prosecution in a very similar way that Johnny Cochran had done during the O.J. Simpson trial, which was very much still in recent Los Angeles memory. Let's talk a little bit about one of Prosecutor Ed Neeson's issues, which is a common problem for prosecutors, and while it technically isn't their fault, it requires a lot of work to address in an effective way. We're talking about what to do when your key eyewitnesses have real credibility issues. It's far more common for crimes to be witnessed by other criminals than by church-going Boy Scouts who volunteer in soup kitchens. That is the nature of a criminal practice, and this is especially true in cases involving gang violence. Ed Neeson did not get to pick and choose who was there to see what happened during the shooting. He has to take his witnesses as they come. There's a very common line that you'd hear in closing arguments made by prosecutors when they have witnesses who are either cooperators or who are getting a benefit for testifying or who are otherwise unsavory people. And that is that if they had angels who witness crimes, they would gladly put them on the stand. But unfortunately, that doesn't ever seem to happen. So what do you do when you have Deshaun Joseph and Jason London as your key star eyewitnesses? As a prosecutor, when you have two gang members who just watched their friend get shot and you want them to testify against the shooter and his entourage, you have to speak with them immediately. You have to assume that the statements that they gave to the police either at the scene or immediately after are chock full of lies, and you have to do everything within your power to remedy that immediately. You need to sit down with them. Explain that if they want to get the guys who killed their friend, they have to be 100% honest, completely and unapologetically. This isn't about them and what they've done in the past. It's about making sure that God's honest truth comes out. If Neeson had known about Woldemariam's gun earlier, if he'd been able to get them to fix their story within a few days, they would have come across so much more credible at the trial. As it was, they persisted in their lies for months, in some cases years, before all of the inaccuracies that they said were finally confronted with contradictory information, and they were forced to admit that they hadn't been telling the truth. When you only come clean because you've been caught in the lie, it doesn't give you credibility. Good defense attorneys latch onto these details and continue to hammer at these eyewitness accounts and can convince a jury to dismiss anything damaging to the defendant because the witnesses have already shown a propensity to fabricate whatever they think will sound better than the truth. And the truth is, many attorneys will say that there's only so much you can do. You can't force people to be honest. You can threaten, you can beg, you can plead, you can yell, you can employ whatever psychological tactics you want. But at the end of the day, you simply cannot control a witness's behavior, and ultimately, you just have to take them as they come. I don't say that. I don't really believe that. To me, that sounds like a cop-out for lawyers who would rather throw their hands up and say, well, I tried, as opposed to laying awake at night, figuring out exactly how to get through to your witnesses. There is always a way. Sometimes it takes a massive amount of effort and work to find it. The jury in Brodus's case deliberated for 6 days in mid-February 1996. At the end of it, on February 20th, they came back and returned a verdict of not guilty on the murder charges for both Brodus and Malik Lee. Brodus and Lee were both still facing voluntary manslaughter, and Brodus was facing accessory charges. The following day, February 21st, Brodus was acquitted of the accessory charge. And at that point, the jury sent a note to the judge on the case, the Honorable Judge Paul Flynn, that they were deadlocked 9-3 in favor of acquitting on the voluntary manslaughter charge. Judge Flynn then declared a mistrial for both Brodus and Lee as it related to that particular charge. We've covered mistrials on this program in the past, so if you've listened to prior episodes, you know that when a jury is deadlocked, they cannot come to a unanimous verdict, the judge can declare a mistrial, and the prosecutors can elect to bring the case again. It is important to keep in mind, though, that if the jury did come back with verdicts on some of the charges, and those verdicts were not guilty, a retrial cannot include those charges. They are over and done with. Double jeopardy has attached, and they are over. So even though the jury deadlocked on voluntary manslaughter, since they acquitted on both the murder and accessory charges, if Neeson wanted to retry the case, he would only be able to charge voluntary manslaughter. He could not include the murder or accessory charge. This same concept applies when a person wins an appeal and the appeals court orders a new trial. Let's say Gregory is charged with murder. He goes to trial and argues that he was under extreme emotional disturbance at the time that he killed the victim in the case. The jury agrees and finds that EED applies. As a result, the jury acquits of the murder charge and convicts of the lower manslaughter charge. As an operation of law, a finding of extreme emotional disturbance reduces a murder charge to manslaughter. So let's say then that Gregory is sentenced on the manslaughter conviction, goes to prison. Now, let's say that some information comes out, which casts serious doubts on whether Gregory received a fair trial. His lawyers file an appeal, and the higher court agrees that Gregory's trial was unfair and deprived Gregory due process. It orders a new trial for Gregory. Since Gregory was technically acquitted on the murder charge through a jury finding extreme emotional disturbance, he cannot be put on trial again for murder. The most serious charge at his new trial would be manslaughter. Ultimately, the Los Angeles County District Attorney elected not to roll the dice and retry Calvin Brodus or Malik Lee. They licked their wounds and they limped away. Snoop Doggy Dogg went on to have one of the most prolific careers in rap music history. While the Merriam's family filed a $25 million wrongful death suit after the verdict. And in August of 1996, the suit was settled for an undisclosed amount, nearly 3 years to the day from when Walda Merriam was shot. In summation, there is something to be said for fame's contribution to a criminal defense. It doesn't always mean that the celebrity will escape legal liability, certainly, but one of the jobs of the defense attorney at the trial is to make the jury feel like they know the defendant. If they get to know him or her, then they're less likely to convict. When the defendant is a celebrity, especially someone whose rise to prominence is recent, jurors will already have a little bit of that feeling. They will identify with the defendant, and will feel some sympathy or empathy for them. This same phenomenon can happen when a celebrity is the victim. Notoriety breeds credibility, even though often the opposite should be true. Many celebrities carefully cultivate their public persona, and it's often nothing like who they are when they want to just be themselves. But that's just not how people think of it. They want to be a part of it. They want to be accepted by it. And subconsciously, you can understand people's desires to be liked by celebrities and why they might bend the rules a bit to give a celebrity what they want, because just maybe this famous person will think a little bit highly of them. When famous people or rich people or powerful people like us, it somehow means more than when your average friend compliments you. We are a status-driven society. We strive for acceptance from people who we perceive to be higher on the hierarchy than we are. In criminal trials, this can sometimes affect how juries react. If, say, O.J. Simpson is on trial, even for something as horrific as the murder of his wife, it's not unbelievable to think that some jurors might have been big fans of his when he was a professional football player, have seen him at press conferences, giving interviews, maybe on commercials or in movies or advertisements, and would think to themselves, I know this guy, he would never have done something like this. This same principle applies even when the person's celebrity is born from infamy. Look at John Gotti, the first man to beat a serious federal RICO case. He was a New York socialite while directing the largest organized crime family in the country, and people loved him for it. Brodus doubtless enjoyed some of that. Hip-hop and rap were relatively new still. And even though Brodus, through his stage alias Snoop Doggy Dogg, was a pioneer of the gangster form of rap, which sensationalized violence against women and law enforcement, was extremely homophobic, glorified drugs and gang life, none of that mattered. It was that he had status that mattered. He was in the same circles as Dr. Dre and Suge Knight. He had influence. Leading up to his trial, many people tried to paint him to be a product of the art form he was advancing. They argued that he was just another street thug gang member and that he should be treated like the criminal that he was. David Kennert is an excellent trial lawyer. He still practices in Los Angeles. He was recently hired by Tory Lanez, the man convicted of shooting Megan Thee Stallion in the foot, in an attempt to appeal for a new trial. Kennert understood exactly where the fault lines of the Snoop Doggy Dogg murder case were. He and Johnny Cochran very effectively determined where to hit the prosecution, and it paid off big time. Neeson had a lot of problems with the Brodus prosecution. Some of them were indeed beyond his control. The LAPD lost and destroyed evidence. Neeson has no ability to prevent that or to ensure the LAPD does what it is supposed to do in that particular regard. It's not on him. But unfortunately, he is the one who takes the hits for it. You have to wonder if his two gang member witnesses had done just a little better, would that have tilted the scales in his favor at all? London and Joseph were terrible prosecution witnesses. On the key issue, was Waldemariam going for a gun to shoot Lee and or Brodus when he was shot? They fed the defense exactly what they wanted, what they needed. Neeson had to prepare them better. If they conveyed to Neeson that was the God's honest truth when he was interviewing them, then he needed to elicit that from them when he was questioning them and allow them to explain it in a way that didn't support self-defense. If they couldn't convince Neeson that it wasn't self-defense, then this case should have never been brought. The fact is, London and Joseph sunk the prosecution of Calvin Brodus. A very special thank you to Eric Stipe, who edited today's episode. If you want to get in touch with me to suggest a topic or case, you want to ask a question about criminal law, or you just want to send me a message unrelated to the show, please feel free to email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod. I'm on Instagram at insummation, and you can check out the show's website, insummation.com. show also has a Facebook page, or you can look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. And, very exciting, InSummation also now has a TikTok account, where I address some of the brief questions I get from friends or from emails. So if you have a short question on a specific topic in the realm of criminal law, I may answer it on the InSummation TikTok account. As always, I appreciate the thoughtful messages that I get and the discussions that they generate. And if you disagree with me, you're always free to let me know what you think and why. And who knows, maybe you'll change my mind. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show. And if you rate and review it, it'll help other people find it as well. And if you're new, please feel free to check out our entire prior catalog. As always, thanks so much for stopping by, and I really hope that you'll come back for more.
My money on my mind, rolling down the street.